From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, TV's late night host had a field day with the election. A critic tells us who got her vote. Then the new HBO film, We Are Not Done Yet, follows veterans with PTSD who find healing through art. Joe Merritt is one of them.
I very rarely thought about it in a way that you would think about when you go look at a painting at a fancy gallery. I approached art and thought about it as like, I have to say this thing, because if I don't get it out of me, it's going to kill me.
And an exiled Iranian composer makes his presence felt back home. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, streaming now only on Netflix.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. There certainly was no shortage of drama in last night's midterm elections, and depending on which candidates you were rooting for, you might have shed a tear or two. But if you stayed up long enough, there was a time and a place to laugh. Several of TV's late-night hosts covered the elections live. Well, live if you were watching in the Eastern time zone. Lorraine Ollie is the LA Times TV critic, and when she joined me in studio today, I started our conversation by asking where she goes for late-night laughs and political insight, especially on a night like last evening.
I'd say Stephen Colbert is one of my favorites. He still is able to pull off that kind of edgy humor that he did, you know, way back when, before he was the big star that he is now. I think consistently he has been the sharpest and the funniest of the group. You know, weekly I love John Oliver, but daily I love Trevor Noah. I think he's pretty great. Totally different style from Stephen Colbert. And Seth Meyers, he's a little more strident, but I would say, like, if you're really pissed off, Seth is your guy.
Let's talk about what happened last night, because a lot of people went live. They typically are pre-taped. When the House results were coming in, here's what Stephen Colbert had to say about the Democrats retaking control of the House.
This is it. The Democrats have taken control of half of one of the three branches of government. All the GOP has is the other half of Congress, the Supreme Court, and a president who does whatever he wants. So far...
Now, here's Trevor Noah's take on the midterms themselves.
There was another vote that had me worried today. Yeah, the midterms. The day when voters were officially going to decide, is America racist or is it openly racist?
So let's talk, first of all, about how they do as live hosts as opposed to people who record in front of a live audience but go back and fix little mistakes here and there.
I think Colbert is used to being live more so than Trevor Noah is. And you could see that when you were watching Colbert last night. You know, even with his last election special, which was live, which was during the, you know, presidential election, you could even see the differences last night in terms of how he was able to handle and pivot things. Trevor Noah, it was a little bumpy for him last night, but still, I think because stylistically he's so different, it still worked. And I thought they both tackled really different things. And Trevor Noah particularly, you know, he's South African, so he tackled race, and he tackled it straight on. He didn't use, you know, racially charged language. He said, no, it's racist. Like, it was flat out. And it was kind of refreshing to see that. They served a kind of almost cathartic look at what was going on, because whether you were celebrating the Dems taking the House or, you know, the Republicans holding on to the Senate, they kind of explored that in between of, like, the roller coaster ride that this has been. And I think Stephen Colbert called it the midterms that have lasted 2,000 years or something like that. And it was like, yes, you're right. It's been 2,000 years.
So not only does CBS do Colbert live on the East Coast, but we can't see it on the West Coast. We have to wait a couple of hours to see it. Why don't they even stream it? Why can't we see it when it's happening?
It's like they're punishing us. They're punishing us. We're not even allowed to stream it. Believe me, I have tried in several.
You have your all satellite streaming pirated hookup sites.
I'm practically on my roof with a little tinfoil hat on trying, and it still won't happen. It's punishment. Nope, 3 hours. That's the deal, John.
I want to talk about Saturday Night Live. One of its cast members, Pete Davidson, appeared on Weekend Update, the show's newscast, for its pre-election segment. And Davidson sparked a lot of controversy with a joke about GOP congressional candidate Dan Crenshaw. He's a former Navy SEAL. He lost his eye fighting in Afghanistan in 2012. He now wears an eye patch. Let's listen to a clip of Pete Davidson on Saturday Night Live.
This guy's kind of cool, Dan Crenshaw.
Oh, come on, man.
Yo, hold on. You may be surprised to hear he's a congressional candidate from Texas and not a hitman in a porno movie. I'm sorry, I know he lost his eye in war or whatever.
Dan Crenshaw actually said after he won that he thinks Saturday Night Live helped him win. And before the joke, that cringing voice you heard was Weekend Update co-host Michael Che. And NBC has declined to comment on what Davidson said. But when probed on The View, SNL cast member Kenan Thompson said the matter was being handled internally. So is it possible you can go too far? And I guess if you believe Dan Crenshaw, you can go too far and actually help somebody that you're trying to criticize.
Yes, I mean, you can go too far, but it's like so hard to tell what that line is now. Like, I was just watching the press conference this morning of Trump and like, what is too far? It's really hard to know what that line is. But for sure, the Saturday Night Live segment, I don't know what they were thinking. It wasn't funny and it was super offensive and it was just kind of like a common sense. That's not very good.
No, and it's clearly not ad-libbed because there was a photograph of Crenshaw on screen. So clearly the producers knew it was coming.
Right, right. And, I'm sure it did help him. I mean, did you know who he was before that? I didn't. So it's like, oh, who is it? Okay, I'm sure that gave him some kind of boost as well.
When you think about where late night has been, where it could go, are you going to keep watching? Do you think they have some insights?
I think the role they're playing is really cathartic. I mean, I think you have to laugh at this stuff. Otherwise, we are just going to implode. I think Colbert is a really good example. I think last night he held up a chart of all sorts of different like emojis of emotions. You know, happy, sad, scared. Which one were you feeling tonight? What did you feel? And he's like, all of them, right, click. And he just throws it out and you're like, you got it. Like, you understand how conflicted and weird this whole thing is.
Lorraine Ali is the TV critic at the LA Times. Lorraine, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up, veterans with PTSD use art and poetry as part of their therapy.
KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting LA's Uncabaret, celebrating 25 years with this one-time-only evening of live comedy, music, and never-before-seen footage from the vault. Featuring Beth Lapidus, Julia Sweeney, Janine Garofalo, Bob Odenkirk, Greg Barron, and Jill Soloway. Also featuring Maria Bamford, Julie Goldman, Byron Bowers, Justin Sayer, and surprise guests. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. To mark Veterans Day, HBO will show a documentary that tracks how a group of vets with traumatic histories turn to art for therapy. The film is called We Are Not Done Yet, and it's produced by the actor Jeffrey Wright, who also appears in the film. The movie follows 10 veterans and active duty service members as they write and stage a collaborative poem. They're participating in a workshop led by the poet Seema Reza, who recruits Wright to help direct the vets in their performance of the poetry. Reza is chair of a nonprofit group called Community Building Artworks. It's an organization that helps people connected to the military find healing and community through all kinds of art. Among the veterans in the film is the artist Joe Merritt, who is the vice chair of the Artworks group. Recently, Merritt and Wright were screening the documentary in Washington, D.C. When I connected with them at an NPR studio there, Wright told me how he got involved.
I've never served, in the military, but I know a little bit about the theater, and sure, I'll come down and see what we can come up with. And that was the intent behind this. It was really a theatrical event, kind of one-off, and we just happened to have the kind of loving eye of Serene Haribedian, whom Seema had asked to come bear witness to this through her camera. she was capturing this process in a very quiet way with a, you know, one other, you know, camera operator in the room. And so it has an intimacy, and it has like almost an accidental quality to it, because our intent at the start was not to make a documentary, but really was to put on this this staged reading.
Joe, you are a veteran. You're also an artist. Before founding Community Building Artworks, can you tell us a little bit about your first experience with art and how it coincided with your service in the Marine Corps?
So I was a little bit interested in art when I was a kid. My dad kind of discouraged it. He's like, don't waste your time with it. So I went on to do other things. I was actually in the Marine Corps when I found art. I was at a program, outpatient program for people with PTSD, and they were doing a lot of exposure-type modality therapies and talk therapies. One of the things that they offered was like, hey, there's this group of veterans who's doing a workshop where they're going to sit down for a week and take your military uniform, they're going to break it down, and you're going to make paper out of it, and then you're going to use that paper to tell your story through art and writing. And I was like, I'll give it a shot. And after the second day, I kind of fell in love with it. Finding ways to be able to tell my story in a way that I still had complete control over it. And also taking, you know, the uniform that I wore in Afghanistan out of the closet and knocking the dust off of it, and being able to proudly take ownership of it and make something that could hang, you know, that I was proud of. Yeah, that was the turning point. That was about 7 years ago. And I've just taken every art opportunity since then.
And how do you see Community Building Artworks taking what you have experienced and what you have learned and letting other people try to go through the same process and maybe get something out of it that traditional talk therapy can't accomplish?
So one of the things that happens when you have trauma or something traumatic happen in your life, there's usually a lot of guilt and shame associated with that. And there's really not a pill for guilt or shame that they've come up with yet. But when you get people together in a room and they start talking to each other and you realize that there's people who will love you, even the worst parts of you, when you're talking about the worst parts of your life, and they love you anyways, and that community starts building, it allows you to have the space where you can heal yourself through that community. And that's one of the main focuses of this nonprofit. Community Building Artworks is doing the same kind of programs that I found that other groups were doing. There's some DOD programs too that are doing this work, but with the DOD, it's really hard to bill an insurance company for painting pictures, and some of this stuff's going away. So this is why we started the nonprofit. It's a group of veterans and artists and from a whole bunch of different types of art, music, writing. And that's our mission, is to bring that place of healing to other veterans and service members.
Jeffrey, I want to play a moment from the film, We're Not Done Yet. And you're directing the veterans. They're starting to stage their collaborative poem. And they're walking on stage. And it seems to be a very simple thing. And it's not. Let's listen to what happens.
How's that feel to everyone?
I hate it.
You hate the lack of structure?
Yes.
The lack of structure.
The breaking formality and following.
Tearing drill apart into something that informal. It just doesn't. My brain can't wrap around it.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It just means
but it is.
My Marine Corps brain, it can't.
So Jeffrey, can you tell me about that moment for you and what was going through your mind and how that moment is really important in the story overall?
Yeah, you know, whenever you're working on a project, you come to these moments where you have to solve problems. But what's distinctive about it, and the reason that we include it in the film, is because it speaks to a level of respect for the training, a level of commitment to serving. That's Bobby Plegman. He talks about, you know, my Marine Corps brain.
You want us to turn left and you want us to come forward, and there are specific commands for that. Forward, march. Ready, halt. Left, face. Forward, march. One step.
We really made a very specific point of shining a light on the ways in which each and every one that we focus on in this film honored their service.
Right.
Because although, you know, they feel in some ways that they have been betrayed by the institution, they feel that they've been injured in some ways as a result of that betrayal. But at the same time, there's never a question in this film that these are people who served with dedication and who served honorably and who did so with respect. And I think that that moment serves to highlight that. And it also speaks to the specificity of, you know, of their histories. And as they try to now define themselves after transitioning out of the military, that's a complicated internal conversation that they have. And I think it's reflective in that moment, too.
Joe, that gets to kind of this bigger idea that's addressed in the film. And it's about how veterans and people who are in service are expected to behave in a very certain and narrow way. And there's a phrase that somebody uses in the film, suck it up and soldier on. And the difference with art is that art doesn't have to follow rules. It can be what that person believes is the best way to express him or herself artistically. So being freed of the confines of prescribed ways to behave, how important is art for people who are used to behaving and expected to behave in a very certain way? How liberating is it, in other words?
When I first started doing art, I very rarely thought about it in a way that you would think about when you go look at a painting at, you know, a fancy gallery or a great work by Leonardo da Vinci. I approached art and thought about it as like, I have to say this thing because if I don't get it out of me, it's going to kill me. So I approached art, and I still try to keep that at the core. And that's something that is the polar opposite of, you know, being a young enlisted service member. You know, if you have a problem, you're supposed to take it up the chain of command. You lose a lot of your choice in what happens to you when you're in the military. Your command has a say, the weather has a say, the terrain has a say, the enemy definitely has a say. Finding ways to create art that give you back control, I think that was the most pivotal life-saving thing about finding art when I did.
When people who are suffering through trauma take a look at this documentary, and they don't necessarily have to be veterans, and they might say to themselves they haven't figured out a way to move forward, they can't find healing, what do you hope they see in this story that they might be able to take up?
One of the things I like about this film particularly is that it's 10 separate people answering that question for 45 minutes, and that's basically what the movie's about. People who have found their individual processes and found a way to give voice to themselves. And a lot of that was done by trying to find a voice together as a community. There's been a couple times already in the short amount since, you know, we started doing film festivals and stuff, and people who weren't in the military didn't even have anybody in the military in their family, just kind of really far removed from that lifestyle, came up and were like, thank you for making this. Thank you for saying it, because I feel like I have a voice again after I watch this movie. I feel like I can take the things that have been hard in my life and apply the same kind of principles and be able to pull myself out of it. And the solutions or the things that are presented in this, in the film as ways of doing that, don't cost anything except for humility and the desire to let go of guilt and shame. So it's not reserved for a class or a demographic. Anybody can have it, whether they're in the military or not.
Joe Merritt is a veteran. He's the vice chair of Community Building Artworks. Jeffrey Wright is an actor. He is a producer of the documentary We're Not Done Yet. Joe and Jeffrey, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
The film We Are Not Done Yet debuts November 8th on HBO. Coming up, an exiled Iranian composer makes his presence felt back home.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, The Other Side of the Wind. The story of a director named J.J. Jake Hannaford, who returns to Hollywood from years of semi-exile in Europe with plans to complete work on his own innovative comeback movie, also entitled The Other Side of the Wind. a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, now streaming only on Netflix.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. A quick reminder, you can also get The Frame as a podcast, and that way you can listen at your convenience and never miss an episode. You'll find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast sources. And now we introduce you to Nima Fakhara. He's one of only three Iranian composers who scores video games and Hollywood films. His work includes The Girl in the Photographs, which was produced by Wes Craven, and the game Detroit Become Human. One of the newer games that Fakhara wrote music for is about a fateful event in his homeland, the Iranian Revolution of 1979, and it's the reason that he can't go home anymore. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving explains.
Nima Fakhara learned how to play the santur before he learned the alphabet.
And you can see it's completely out of tune.
He was born in Tehran, Iran, and he started studying Persian classical music at a very young age.
I was hanging out with a lot of these 70-year-old men that were just kind of, that I had to speak Farsi, and just a very traditional Farsi, not just a day-to-day Farsi. And I was kind of forced into it. I liked it. And I was kind of just became that kid that was like playing music for 8 hours a day. Let me grab a hammer.
But this is the one you had as a kid.
This is the one that I had as a kid, and surprisingly enough, it's lasted me this long. I knew that there was music in films and video games because I was so into it. I loved films and I loved video games, but until I moved to the U.S., I didn't know that there is a field in it. And they don't tell you anything in Iran, so it's because of also the restrictions of it. Even nowadays, I don't think there is video game composers in Iran because there's no video games being produced in Iran.
Fakhara's family moved to Maryland when he was 12. He went to college as a pre-med major, but then he went to a party that changed his life.
And we started jamming a little bit, and it was the first time that I felt music in my body. Kind of like I closed my eyes and I just felt the music. It's like you have an out-of-body experience. I wasn't on drugs or anything like that. It was just, I just felt the music. So on my way home, I actually called up my mom. It was like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I called my mom and I was like, oh, I'm going to be moving to LA to go pursue music.
Which is what he did. He came out here and was studying traditional Western music when he discovered the score for Black Hawk Down by Hans Zimmer.
I realized, Hans is kind of using the traditional Middle Eastern stuff on top of a Western world of, he's using tumbak, he's using dulcimers, he's using very, very different worlds. I was like, oh, I could do this.
Fakhara got a job working for Christoph Beck, composer of Ant-Man and Frozen, and even apprenticed for Zimmer. Then came his own film and video game assignments, like Detroit Become Human. He heard about a game being developed by one of the directors of the Grand Theft Auto series, the Iranian-Canadian Naveed Kansari.
He made a project called 1979 Revolution, Black Friday. The concept of it is that you get dropped into Iran as a journalist, as a student journalist, and then you get to choose your path. You could be part of the regime as part of the police, or you could be the revolutionist as you're kind of walking around taking pictures of things. So I basically called him up 3 years before he was making the project, and I was like, I want to work on this. I got to basically work with him, collaborate on the project with him, and it was very awesome because I was able to bring back some of my root instruments.
The score for 1979 Revolution uses Fakhara's childhood santur and even his voice. But on the day the game came out, it was banned in Iran. And so, effectively, was Nima Fakhara.
Basically, they put a black label on it, as they say. So in Iran, there is a society of arts that there's a bunch of clergies that decide who gets to do any sort of arts or whatsoever. Even if you want to have a concert, you have to have a proposal on what kind of concert you're going to actually put. They listen to your music, they could ban your music. So even if you're making a film, it's the same exact thing. They read your script and they say, oh, this part is banned, you can't do that. So once that happens, if your entire project gets banned, you get on a list that if you go to Iran, you basically kind of, they start questioning you, they throw you in prison, they ask you, oh, why are you talking about the revolution? And that's how I realized, I'm banned from Iran. It's a very weird emotion because I was finally able to work on a project that I wanted to work and be able to kind of go back and actually do something that I loved. But at the same time, it was one of those things that I was like, I knew what I was getting myself into, and I knew I was going to get banned from my own country. And I was like, there's a catch-22 about it. It's like, I want to tell this story, but I know I can't go back to my country.
Fakara says there's even a chance he'll never be able to return. So lately, he's been channeling his energies and love for Iran into something productive, mentoring aspiring film and video game composers who are in Iran from his studio in Los Angeles using the social gaming platform Twitch.
People watch you play video games, but what I've turned it into is a masterclass. And I go on, basically show a scene that I've done. For example, we started doing it for Detroit.
Thank you everyone for hanging out with us. And then this was supposed to be the main theme, but we never did this. Pew, pew, pew. Oh, that happened already. Cool.
And then all of a sudden, I realized there is, of the like the 50 people that are watching, 10 of them are from Iran. And I'm like, what is going on? So I've basically just kind of started mentoring them a little bit closely, just looking at their music and trying to figure out. Again, it's very indirectly, if not person to person, but I'm trying to kind of give back. I mean, one of my dreams is to be able to work on a project in Iran. I would love to be able to kind of tell my own story that way.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that is the show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.